You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The web is in an unforgiving place for news outlets. If you break a story even a second after your competition, you land at the bottom of Google News, and all those coveted unique visitors will go somewhere else. Online reporters are under pressure not only to break the news, but also to increase readership by publicizing their stories on Facebook and Twitter. Joining us now to discuss how news sites cope with these demands are Sri Srinivasan, a professor at the Columbia Journalism School, also Remy Stern, editor-in-chief of Gawker.com, and Helena Andrews, a former reporter at Politico and author of Bitch is the New Black, which is published by Harper. Welcome to our show. Remy, there have been several commentators calling for a slow blogging movement in the wake of the Andrew Breitbart, Shirley Sherrod fiasco. They argue that accuracy is too often sacrificed in favor of speed. First of all, what happens if you're scooped at Gawker? Is it the end of the world?
It's not the end of the world, and it happens all the time, and we are occasionally unhappy about it. But, you know, we will survive, and there will be another story 3 hours later that hopefully we can publish first. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think any one story is sort of make or break for us.
But I guess the big issue for everybody here is how do you balance the two issues of speed and accuracy?
It's a balancing act, and it's something we struggle with every day, to publish something quickly but also make sure we get the facts right. You know, we make mistakes from time to time because we're moving as quickly as we do. We go back and fix those mistakes, and we publish an update or a correction, and readers can see that we've made changes, and we acknowledge the corrections that we've made. But it's difficult. In a perfect world, we would never have to worry about making mistakes in the first place.
Well, newspapers have a clearly defined procedure for story production. The story goes through the assignment editor, and it must be copy edited, fact check. Are there as many steps in getting material out on the web?
Well, it depends on which particular publications we're talking about. In an environment where they're trying to save money and do with many fewer resources, even the biggest publications have had to cut back on some of that layers of editing. And the pressure to get stories fast and get them up there and get them indexed by Google is putting kind of changed the way that people think about how to deal with the news and things online.
Well, in looking over this world, do you see many fact checkers and copy editors?
Well, let's also note that newspapers didn't have fact checkers the way that magazines do. So you've got to kind of separate some of these, you have to compartmentalize some of these. But at the same time, on the web, if you have a big story, it isn't going to be obvious where that's coming from, who's going to break it. It might be Gawker, it might be Politico, it might be ABC News. It could be anybody. It could be one guy just sitting alone and writing a story. So as they're trying to do this,
or publishing an edited video.
No, that's right. And what we are seeing is that places that didn't traditionally emphasize that editing process are trying, in some cases, to do that. But again, it's not always easy.
Well, Remy, you mentioned that you could just go back and correct a story, which is a lot easier than what happened at a newspaper where you had to go through great expense correcting something in a later edition or the embarrassment of issuing a correction the next day. On the other hand, once the error is picked up, isn't it difficult to slow down the train?
It can be there, and that's a problem for everyone. There's misinformation that gets out there early on in the life cycle of a story, and that becomes sort of the dominating headline, even though it turns out, you know, later that story may not have been true. We see that happen all the time. I mean, frankly, we're seeing that happen more and more with newspapers and with magazines in their effort to be more like online media and be more nimble. Mistakes are getting made really by everybody these days.
Helena, I've read that Politico's top editors, Jim VandeHei, and who's the executive editor, and John Harris, editor-in-chief, built Politico precisely to avoid any efficiencies that newspapers might have. What did that mean for the way that Politico operates?
To avoid any inefficiencies that newspapers had.
Or to cut down on the inefficiencies that newspapers have.
Right.
Go ahead.
The idea was when we were working there, and I started at Politico when, you know, before it was even Politico, before we had a name, and the idea was especially bringing in a lot of young green journalists who would be working at this kind of breakneck pace. The idea was that you would get a lot of information out there, right? And that was part of this idea that at a major newspaper, at these huge behemoths like the New York Times or the Washington Post, that people can hide, right? You know what I mean? You can be somewhere in the bullpen, possibly working on a story, but who really knows? Because you're, you know, behind a stack of newspapers. But at the Politico, it was the exact opposite of that. There was always this feeling that you were on a treadmill and that, you know, you were working. You were constantly working. You were constantly churning out copy. And that's, I think, the story that just came out that Jeremy Peters wrote for the New York Times about burnout for young journalists. And that's kind of built into the model because the idea is that you're working, you know, on a constant basis.
Sri, did you see that article? It talks about some of the problems bloggers face, heart attacks, weight gain, sleeping disorders.
Well, these are problems that come from sitting in front of a computer all day and churning out stuff on a steady diet of Coke and fast food. And you don't have time to maybe make that extra phone call or go out and see something because you have to deliver. And that beast has to be fed, not the journalist, but the machine, the website has to be fed. And more, you need a high volume of stories in part for inventory for ads, but also so that the site gets refreshed and the headlines go out and people see them and click on. And so it's a cycle that goes on.
Now, Helena, was there a sense that you should rush to post something as soon as possible and then check the facts later?
Well, definitely not. I mean, Jim and John both came from the Washington Post. Like, these are two people who were definitely raised up in the traditional journalism sensibilities to where, you know, you get your facts right. But there was a rush to get those facts right. You know, you get the facts as right as you can at the moment. And as we were discussing, when it comes to a website, you can always update, you can always correct. But again, if that story has gotten away from you and if it's already been tweeted, it's already been on Facebook, it's already on someone's GChat status, pulling the reins back can be difficult. And that's what we're seeing with the Shirley Sherrod story. It's like all of a sudden a story can take on a life of its own, and pulling the reins back, even though you have that immediate outlet to do so, can be difficult. But definitely, I don't think online there is, it's not the Wild West. You know, people are definitely trying as best they can to get the facts straight, but you also have to get those facts right and as quickly as possible. You don't have a day to wait for someone to call you back. You don't have maybe even 2 hours to wait for somebody to call you back.
Well, you say it's not like the Wild West, but you have compared your time at Politico to being at boot camp.
You know, it was like a journalism boot camp. And you know what? And I said in that story for the Times, like, a lot of people were proud of that. Like, yes, of course, there is a burnout because I think it's built into the model of online journalism that you are on a treadmill as opposed to a ladder. So it can feel like a boot camp. But at the same time, you know, what happens when you come out of boot camp? You come out much stronger. And these are young reporters who worked at the Politico for 2-3 years and then moved on to great positions at the Huffington Post, at Bloomberg. You know, they're moving on to really great positions, but I think one of the issues with online journalism is that a lot of young reporters don't feel like they can necessarily grow in that model as opposed to the traditional news model at a newspaper.
Remy, is Gawker similar to Politico in that regard?
Gawker covers a different range of subjects, but similar in the sense that, you know, we try to get our facts right. I think it's hard to sort of generalize.
Is that boot camp sensibility?
It's certainly a company that's populated by young, aggressive writers who are interested in working very hard, and they do work very hard. And it's not necessarily a pace that you know one can sustain for a very long period of time. I think they're all you know, very aware that this is a great stepping stone to a bigger and better job down the road.
What's the turnover like at Gawker?
Well, it's hard to, I don't know in sort of percentage terms, but fairly high. I mean, I think probably comparable to you know, other sites, probably comparable to Politico. You know, people come.
But not newspapers.
No, I mean, people who are at newspapers often stay for a very, very long time. And
well, hope
stay,
to anyway.
If,
we'll get a buyout,
right,
whatever
exactly.
comes first.
You know, people come and spend a year, 2 years, and hopefully find a great job. And you know, that's encouraged. You know, I certainly won't object if one of our great young writers gets a job at the New York Times and goes on to big things.
My guests are Remy Stern, editor-in-chief at Gawker.com, Helena Andrews, a former reporter at Politico, and Sri Srinivasan, Dean of Student Affairs and professor at Columbia Journalism School. And Sri, it used to be that newspaper reporters would file their stories and then they would move on to do more reporting. What additional responsibilities do reporters have in this age of sites like Facebook and Twitter?
What they have to do is take ownership of getting the word out about the story. There was a time when the story ran and the entire mechanism of the publication or the television station was doing the promotional work to get the eyeballs to the website or to the story. Now, if you work at a website or even if you work at one of the big publications, you have to help get eyeballs to the story. And you do that through Facebook, through Twitter. You heard about putting the story on your Gmail chat status. These are all effort. You want to email 30, 40, 50, 500 friends and tell them, here's my latest story. And you have to take some of that responsibility. This is not what people have done for 100 years. And now they suddenly are told that this is one of the things which will help you in your career and help your stories.
Well, what would happen if an online story, if a reporter hasn't done the work to publicize it? Don't sites like Google News rank stories in part based on how many other sites are linked to them?
Right. So you want your stories seen and picked up by other places. You want your story linked to by Gawker. It will give that kind of a vote within Google News and move that up. You want Politico to pick up your story. And this is an environment where people are connecting with other news organizations and working together to get these stories out there.
And then you want to link to the certain kinds of sites, don't you? Not everybody would want to be linked to the Drudge Report, but the Drudge Report can surely help a story.
Oh, it certainly can. We're always very happy when we get a Drudge link. We see a huge spike in traffic. That's all very true. I mean, we see a couple of hundred emails a day from either media organizations or writers sending us links to stories that they've written, directing our attention to this feature that was published today or that story that was posted online, because people are doing much more promotion. You didn't really see that a few years ago. Certainly didn't see writers promoting their own work in the way that they are now. And you're seeing that most media organizations have somebody who is just sending out links and promoting content on a daily basis.
So, Helena, when you were at Politico, how much time did you spend on the story and how much did you spend on promoting the story?
it's definitely not like a 50-50 situation, even though it can be. I think definitely then, and that was, about a year or two ago, there was this idea, especially, and someone had mentioned earlier, there a lot of these sites hire someone specifically whose job it is just to promote stories, to send out those stories to the booker at CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, to send it to Drudge, to send it to those sites that they know are going to bring more traffic to the website, and specifically to send it to, those 24-hour news organizations like a CNN, like a MSNBC, where you can get your reporters on TV, which drive even more eyeballs to the site. But I think even now, especially, I work as a freelancer now, and I also work for Politics Daily, which is a website owned by AOL, and, it's all about, I had never heard of SEO before I started working there, search engine optimization. You have to think about your headlines and how many eyeballs a smart headline will drive to your story. You've got to think about your Twitter hashtags. You really have to become your own publicist as a journalist, and I think that a lot of journalists, especially journalists who grew up in the I guess we call it now the old media model. If you have new media, you have to have old media, might resent that. And there might be some pushback because you think, oh, well, I'm a writer. I wrote the story. That's the job that I was hired for. That's the job I'm supposed to be doing. But it's increasingly becoming, you know, just one of your many jobs. You do have to do a lot of publicity. You have to have a Facebook page. You have to have a Twitter page. You know, you can't really survive in this current media climate without those things.
We'll talk about eyeball counting and other matters when we return after a little break. My guests are Helena Andrews, former reporter for Politico, now the author of a book called Bitch is the New Black from Harper, Remy Stern, editor-in-chief of Gawker.com, and Sri Srinivasan, the dean of student affairs and a professor at Columbia Journalism School. Stay with us. We're back with Sri Srinivasan, dean of student affairs and professor at Columbia Journalism School, Helena Andrews, former reporter at Politico, and Remy Stern, the editor-in-chief of Gawker.com. Remy, newspapers can't really know which of their articles are being read, but on the web, can't you get instant feedback on what people are following?
You can, and certainly at large media companies, they can see certain statistics that they may not reveal to the public at large. We happen to post how many people viewed a specific story, both the number of page views, as well as the number of unique visitors for each story. So people can tell how popular a story is on our site.
Well, if it's an important story, and as far as you're concerned, it doesn't get many eyes. On the other hand, there's another one that you think is negligible, but really is has a lot of people reading it. You're going to focus on the second one, aren't you?
It's a balancing act. There are stories that we do that we know are not going to be huge hits, and we do have to do them anyway because they're important stories or they relate to something that we do very well. But it certainly influences the kind of coverage we do. There are things that we may cover a second time because it was so popular the first time we wrote about it.
Are staff members rewarded for posting stories that attract a lot of viewers?
There is a bonus plan which rewards writers for traffic. It's gravy. I mean, everybody is paid a regular salary, but in addition to that, there is a bonus that rewards writers for writing stories that are big stories and get widely circulated.
Was that in effect at Politico when you were there, Helena?
No, it wasn't. I don't know, you know, what it is now, and honestly, because a lot of the people who I started with at Politico no longer work at Politico, they all moved on to different or bigger, quote-unquote, media outlets. But it wasn't the case in terms of there being, like, this built-in system of there being a bonus if your story got more page views or more hits. But, you know, there was definitely, you know, just like at the New York Times where you got that front-page story, it's, you know, a story that's very popular, most emailed on a website is equivalent to a front page story, basically. And you do get a slap on the back. You know, you don't get this, you know, gold plate that people used to get at the New York Times when you got your first front page story, but you definitely, you know, people know what are the most popular stories. It's something that's not just whispered about around the newsroom. You know blatantly whose story is on the front page of the website and whose story might be emailed the most. And you know, you're rewarded for that in other ways besides maybe monetarily.
Sri?
Well, actually, I think that the advent of having most popular, most emailed, most viewed, all most commented up there, and the ability to sort your website according to those stories, in some ways has had a kind of self-reinforcing thing. So somebody might come in there and say, I have very little time. I'm going to go see what's the most emailed, what's the most viewed, what's the most commented, and then that becomes automatically gets a push that it might not otherwise have had.
And by the way, it's happening at the New York Times as well.
Sure. NYTimes.com/most popular is a page that lists all of these things, and you can go back. And the editors tell the reporters, don't worry about this. But by publishing it and making it so obvious, I know people at the New York Times who spend a small part of their day sending out their stories to their friends and mailing lists and everything else, because they know that people are looking at that list. And when you look at those lists, you know, it's not necessarily the most important stories that are up there, but things that are kind of service journalism, entertainment journalism, those are the things that rank high on there. Those modern love columns show up there. And there's nothing wrong with that in some ways.
Sometimes it's actually not a pretty picture. There's one news organization, I won't mention which one, that noticed that all of the most viewed stories were these really gory crime stories. And actually went and manually changed the list because they were so horrified by the headlines.
Oh, I would
have thought
they would just focus on gory crime stories.
Well,
a lot of tabloid newspapers have done.
Sure. I mean, if you're a big mainstream news organization, you don't necessarily want, you know, axe murderers just right down the right-hand side of the page. But
isn't there a large monitor hanging in your offices called Big Board?
There is a monitor that displays the most popular stories at in the last hour, which is a way of giving a tip of the hat to the writer who just posted something that was very successful.
Well, how do you view the importance of how do you tabulate all of this? Is it just a matter of the number of people who view a page in which the article is posted, or are there other factors like counting how many people have emailed the story to their friends?
There are lots of different metrics, and different sites use different metrics. We pay a lot of attention to unique visitors, which are the actual number of people who come and visit read a story. There are also page views. Page use, if you go and you visit a story 10 times, there's 10 page views. One unique visitor, but 10 page views.
How much if I spend just seconds looking at it? Does that matter?
Yes, that would still – you know, there are ways to monitor how long people spend on a site per visit. That's not really a number that we spend a lot of time focused on.
So, yeah, how many different things can they find out about a story?
That's just the start, right? You can also see how many comments somebody got on a story. I know someone who's an editor-in-chief.
Now, would comments matter? Sometimes I've looked at comment pages, and the commenters get into these ridiculous debates.
Right.
And you know, if you count them all up, there's a lot of comments, but 98% of them are stupid.
Right, but you're right. But what happens is when you look at a story and it says next to it 50 comments, and then there's a story with 3 comments, the human mind might say, "All right, let me go read the one with 50 comments," without knowing what the quality of the comments is. Just, I would just say that I know an editor in chief in New York who keeps a list, a spreadsheet that goes beyond the traditional just byline count, how many stories have you done, but also tracks page views, comments, email, you know, all of that stuff to say that if they have to make decisions about who to keep, who to promote, they're going to start using these in a way that other websites have been doing for years, but now mainstream publications are also looking at that.
Comments are a reflection of where the discussion is taking place. What are people talking about? So, you know, while you may see really crummy comments on some sites, you know, it also is a good way to just sort of see, you know, what are people interested in chatting about? What stories sort of set off this conversation, this discussion?
Helena, you wanted to add something?
I mean, I would say specifically about comments, because I know as a reporter, a lot of reporters kind of just loathe the comment section because so often it takes on an entire life of its own. You know, your story might be about one thing and the comment section will just explode to have absolutely nothing to do with the story that you wrote.
Right. You mentioned Mars, and the next thing you know, everybody's talking about Mars,
exactly.
Even though you were using it in a metaphor.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of websites now are realizing that and realizing that the comment section. But like, you know, someone said earlier, if you do have that story with 100 comments as opposed to that story with 0, yes, a reader will definitely click on that story. But then once you get to the comments and realize that most of these people are, you know, in their pajamas saying just ridiculous things because they can, because the anonymity the internet gives you, sometimes that can have a negative effect then on the readers who are clicking on that story as well. So I know at Politics Daily, they've started this civilogue in terms of not just letting anyone comment, that comments have to be monitored. They're monitored very specifically. And only those best comments or those comments that actually reflect something intelligent are viewed on the site, actually make it on the site. And I think that a lot of websites and new media organizations in this new age are realizing that comments, though they are one metric that they can be a little bit misleading.
My guess, and I just have to tell everyone that I'm talking with Helena Andrews, former reporter at Politico, Remy Stern, editor-in-chief of Gawker.com, and Srinivasan, who's the Dean of Student Affairs and a professor at Columbia Journalism School. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You wanted to add something, Remy?
Oh, and that was a very good point that was just made. We've never actually had open comments. We've never allowed just anybody to comment, which I think is just one of the great things. And you know, actually didn't think it was such a great idea at the time it was instituted, you know, years ago. But in order to comment on Gawker or any of its sister sites, you actually have to audition, which is that you have to post something in the comment section that's really smart. And if you if one of the editors approves it, then you have access to comments in the future. So you essentially have to show us that you're worthy of commenting. And so if you have nothing really to contribute, then you know you're not somebody that we would want in the comment section. And we love commenters because they actually help us in so many ways. You know, they keep us honest. They point out typos. They add new details to a story in the comment section. They point out things that, you know, it's a transparency and support.
And they argue
us.
With you.
And they argue with us, and they sometimes provoke us. And
Sri?
Another thing that you're seeing is that people are websites are encouraging readers to log in with their Facebook or their Twitter IDs. And what that means is then you're no longer you're more real than you were, because if you're on Facebook and you are real on Facebook, then you're less likely to have all the problems of a made-up name that you might have in a regular commenting system. But there's another advantage. If you allow people to comment via Facebook, then their friends on Facebook who've never heard of your website or your story are then noticing that, gee, my friend Jane just commented on this particular story, and they might go there. And so you're seeing this rise of how social media plays a role here as well.
Well, you teach a course for reporters on using social media.
Yeah.
Can someone really break stories just by browsing blogs and social networks?
Oh, it's not like that. What you have to do is use social media to listen a lot more. We've been talking about how to use social media to promote your work, mm-hmm. but you also use social media to listen, to hear about new ideas, new trends, new sources. And the more you are in listening mode as opposed to broadcasting mode, the better off you are in terms of getting an opportunity to pick up stuff that might otherwise be things that don't cross your radar.
Well, in the old days, reporters went out and to the field and looked for a story. Are they missing something if they're not continuously monitoring these websites?
Well, you have to do both. And the good news about social media, I like to tell journalists, is that it's in addition to the good or bad news is that it's in addition to what you bring to the table already, your experience, your skills, your reporting ability, your contacts, your Rolodex, all of that you still need. But you also want to be in this way out there listening, because some of your sources are now talking, sharing information first on these social networks before they issue a press release, before they call a reporter. So you need to be able to play in both places.
At Gawker, Remy, do reporters spend most of the day at their computers looking for stories? How often do they go out in the field?
They do. Occasionally we have people who go out and report on a story, and it takes them out of the office. And there's a certain amount of reporting that, you know, that can get done in the office using the phone and computer. But that was a very good point. I mean, I think we find that there are fantastic stories that are getting that are, you know, every day.
Well, your homepage has a bar at the top that asks readers for story ideas. So how much of your content comes from reader suggestions?
A fair amount. We get hundreds and hundreds of tips sent to us every day, and people also post them on the site directly, and everybody can see those tips. And then there's a lot of information that we get by doing just what was said, which is, you know, we're whether it's Twitter or it's Facebook or it's people's blogs, just looking everywhere and scanning thousands of different sites for information, for stories.
Helena, in the old days, you would have gone to work for a newspaper, and somebody would have taken you under his or her wing and you had gotten guidance. You might have bonded with an editor or two and learned the business that way. How does it work at a place like Politico?
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. I don't think it works at most places that way any longer. You know, I started in the business after I got my master's from Columbia, but I did go to Columbia undergrad. I started as a clerk at the New York Times Washington Bureau, and there are, you know, and the first thing that they would tell us was like, listen, in the old days, that's how you became a reporter at the New York Times. You started as a clerk, you worked your way up, maybe you covered the police beat, maybe you did, you know, Metro, and then, you know, worked your way up through the organization. They're like, that is no longer the case. You know, it's just not going to happen. And so after I was the clerk at the New York Times, I left there and went to Politico, and it's like I described it previously, it is like a boot camp. You get in there and it's like, okay, you just kind of hit the ground running. And I think especially in the new media model, you don't necessarily have these pairings of great reporters and great editors who, you know, are together for their entire career for the next 20 years. That just simply isn't the case anymore. It's much more every man, woman for his or herself. And that can be disheartening, especially if you're, you know, coming up in journalism and, you know, you watched All the President's Men and thought that was going to be the case in terms of what the newsroom was like. And it isn't like that anymore. And I remember at Northwestern, when I first started, they showed us this video where it was like, you know, a reporter and they would report on the story and then switch the laptop around and then do like a broadcast and then, you know, strap something to his back and, you know, I don't know, shoot off to Mars. It's like the reporter has to do all these amazing things and have all these new skills. And that is, it can be disheartening when you first start in the business, I think, because a lot of people don't know that. But as we move forward in places like Columbia and places like Northwestern now have a new media major. You know, you can major in new media and know that it's a different part of the business these days.
Sherry, on the other side of this story, a caller mentioned that in 2003, the New York Times held a story about how the government was spying on its citizens. If they had published it earlier, some people felt it might have changed the election results and hurt Bush's chances. So he asks, far more than Facebook, blogs, and Twitter, isn't it more an issue of whether or not these guys have the guts to tell the stuff that government might not want to hear? He's thinking specifically of what happens with a source like WikiLeaks.
And you saw how that the entire thing was orchestrated. They worked with the White House. They, you know, they redacted certain parts of the stories and those documents. So I think that the good news about all of this stuff is that we are going to see that there are going to be more opportunities for young people and for others who have stories they want to tell. You don't have to be beholden to a publicly owned company with 50 years tradition or 60 years tradition. So you get the choice. If you have a story that you want to break, there'll be places that wouldn't have existed before. One of my former students started this website called Tehran Bureau, which covers Iran and is very well known now. But she just wanted to tell the story of what's going on in Iran and did it better than most other places. So it is possible to do that. You're also seeing one other point is that young people now who are not on a ladder, if you will, and have to work their way to interviewing the president or doing big foreign policy stories or here in New York covering the mayor, you're able to do that at a younger age, which can be both good and bad. You're making mistakes at a bigger level. You're doing stories at a bigger level, but also making mistakes at a bigger level. A website that I'm involved with, dnainfo.com, which covers Manhattan, you have our young reporters out there breaking stories, covering stuff that they would have had to wait many years to be able to do.
We have to leave it there, but my great thanks to the three of you, Sri Srinivasan, Dean of Student Affairs, Professor at Columbia Journalism School, Helena Andrews, a former reporter at Politico. She's written a book called Bitch is the New Black. It's from Harper. And Remy Stern, who is editor-in-chief at Gawker.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.